my name is Tom Rossing. I'm a practicing scientist. I guess most of my scientific career has been spent in the proverbial academic ivory tower, but I did begin my career in industry, and I do a fair amount of industrial consulting. And I know we have several industrial scientists and engineers in the group. We've got resource personnel. I guess what I wanted to do first was attempt at least to define technology, and in particular, I guess, to relate science and technology, since the terms overlap, the fields overlap. And the understanding of the rather artificial divisions between the two are not always clear. Science, in its purest sense, is just the study of nature without any particular implications as to how the information that we gather about the universe might be used. Technology, on the other hand, applies this scientific knowledge. Webster says, technology is the science of the application of knowledge to practical purposes. Now, you have to go on then and look up practical and find out what that means. And that means available, usable, or valuable in practice or action. I guess I have no quarrel with those terms. I sometimes think of science and technology as forming kind of a continuous spectrum from very pure science that has no immediate application, or for which we don't foresee the application, through the more applied fields of science, and then to the technology and the rather research-oriented technologists, and then the people who are really concerned with the nitty-gritty of producing goods that have some scientific basis. And the people who work in science and technology have interests at various places along this rather broad spectrum. Sometimes scientists object very much to people confusing them with being technologists. The better living through through chemistry bit. Others, scientists, are rather proud of the fact that they are primarily problem solvers. Well, I guess one of the pleasant surprises at this afternoon session on conservation of energy was that I didn't get more than one third of the way through the material I had prepared, because the discussion was so interesting. And I hope the same sort of thing happens tonight. I've got a goodly number of questions that I've written down here that we might want to discuss. I hope we get so involved in them that we never do get through the list. But let me read this list of about a dozen or more questions that I thought of to jot down. I hope you'll think of some more. And then you may wish to address your answers to any of these questions or any other questions that you might have on the subject. In what ways do science and technology improve the quality of life? In what ways do they degrade the quality of life? How much science and technology are we willing to support? How much of this support should come from the public sector of society? How much from the private sector? To what extent should science and technology be subject to public control? Are some types of scientific research too dangerous to allow? Has public understanding of science and technology kept pace with discovery and invention? How can we improve scientific literacy in the U.S.? Should all scientific research be open to public scrutiny? Should all new inventions be public domain? Should the Department of Defense, for example, be allowed to classify the results of scientific research in the interests of national defense or national security? Should an inventor be allowed exclusive right to his invention, or should he be required to license competition? Are we training enough scientists, engineers, medical practitioners, and related professions to meet our future needs? And a related question, should we allow or encourage scientists from developing countries to emigrate to the U.S. or to remain in the United States after their education is completed? Well, these are the questions that I jotted down, and I think I hope that any of them could develop into some lively discussion. Let me, before I throw it open to addressing these questions while you're thinking of your answers, let me reiterate what was said at a forum here about a week and a half ago. In fact, I guess that was really what led to this session on my suggesting a session like this on technology. The statement was made that I guess to the effect that something about pollution and environmental damage were caused by our new technological society. And I rather objected to that. In fact, I said that I could make a pretty good case, I thought, for just the opposite, that without our advanced technology, the amount of pollution and environmental degradation would be much greater. And that the real cause, I felt, of damage to our environment was when consumption grows ahead or beyond the ability of technology to create these goods and services that without degrading the environment. Now, if I can elaborate, if anyone wants to challenge that statement or comment on it, I'd be glad to elaborate more on it, or I'd be glad to hear your comments on any of the questions I raised, or anything else on this subject. So let me just throw it wide open. Okay.
I was interested in the question about should our government be able to keep secret the technology that they've made in the name of defense. And I guess I would say no, because at this point I feel that with the Trident submarine and the MX missile and all of these other outrageous things that I feel that they're outrageous, that my tax money is going towards that, and I would rather have my tax money go for human needs rather than for something that is going to destroy our human race.
Well, I guess you're, I hear you saying two things. One is that they shouldn't keep, classified the way to build a Trident submarine, since it was paid for government funds.
No, I would feel they shouldn't keep it classified as much as they have that they're even making it, because I feel a lot of people
Well, I don't guess they have. I guess the number of Trident submarines we have in this country is public domain, isn't it? That's well known. In fact, we think we know even how many the Soviet Union have. But how the advanced systems aboard them work is a certain classified.
I think it was kept classified for a long time, so that the public couldn't stop them from being made. And then we could find out.
You mean that they existed?
Right. But I just feel that all of us have a lot of our money going towards something that maybe we don't want our money to be going towards. Mm-hmm. So that's just my thought.
Seems to me that's a different issue than technology. That's an issue of national policy. You know, do you want to be a world power and try to keep the balance for world threats, or you want to withdraw? I think that's a different policy question than technology. The technology question is, like you say, all the stuff's being turned out and how it's used, and that I think involves values and involves economic questions, and value questions of what's value to society.
But isn't that part of the larger question? Technology brings us all sorts of good things that we like very much, and I suspect most of us would be loath to give up. But it also brings about these other things, these things that you claim are outrageous, and they are. can you have one side without the other? Technology is, seems to be both redemptive and demonic, the way the forum is set up tonight.
But it's not technology that's redemptive and demonic, it's the people that administer it. I mean, technology is a neutral thing.
Can that be added to the list of questions?
Okay.
I mean, to take that statement and put a question mark after it, instead of a period. I think that's a very important question, whether technology is in fact neutral, a kind of neutral set of tools.
I guess I'd sort of raise another question in response to your question, and that is it killing that's outrageous, or is it any particular method of killing that's outrageous? Down through history, we've established some, quote, rules of warfare, quote, and I've always thought that was, that's a real dichotomy. War is okay as long as you play it according to the rules. So it's okay to shoot people, but don't send missiles with nuclear warheads or whatever.
Well, that's tomorrow night's forum.
Ah, okay. Yeah, okay. All right.
I sort of, as the time goes, I've kind of forgotten the question. I think it was the second one. Read your second question. Will you?
Okay, that was how much science and technology are we willing to support, and how much of this support should come from the public sector?
Oh, okay. Well, that wasn't the question I wanted to address, but it was in there somewhere. I sort of feel like science should be studied as a pure science. You had mentioned at the beginning that some scientists just believe that they study nature and the universe for its own sake. And I feel very strongly that kind of pursuit of knowledge is something that we have to keep doing.
But the applied science and technology are quite so important.
But what?
But that applied science and technology aren't as important.
Well, I'm not saying that they're not as important, but I feel like the study of, gathering of knowledge is very important, and it should be allowed, I mean, it should continue without limits, but I almost think that.
Well, most scientists would be glad to hear you say that. Senator Proxmire would.
See, you could say that pure science should be encouraged. The practical applications should have a value system. Well, who's going to set that? Yeah. And maybe by tax incentives or tax deterrence, you will discourage products being developed that dehumanize society or pollute it. And on the other hand, enhance those that do, but it gets kind of difficult. All the developing countries in the world today are having declining populations, lower birth rates. All the underdeveloped countries and developing countries are having population explosions. Ironically, they are also having lower birth rates. The reason they're having population explosions is because technology has wiped out malaria and all the other things that have wiped out children. Now they're going to starve to death when they're 25, or they're going to have a revolution. Now we got to get technology to raise more food, you know what? So now we're going to have to call on technology to solve the problem of all these people in the developing countries that have to have food.
I'd like to kind of pursue that question you mentioned about, how'd you put that, that technology needs to have to do with keeping abreast, but not too fast. Is that again?
About public understanding of technology?
No. It was a
pollution question that you.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
How did you phrase that?
Well, I made the statement that I, in my opinion, the pollution occurs and environmental degradation occur when our consumption forges ahead of the of our technology.
Yeah.
We consume at a greater rate than technology is able to furnish these goods and services.
I think when you're mentioning it, again, there's so many interrelations here, and they all seem to me to come down so much to the human factor. so that we're related here again to economics, and we are constantly being influenced to consume more and more so that people can sell more and more things, that many of which we really don't need, you know, all the gadgets and stuff, and yet, and that consume energy and so forth, and yet it's profitable to somebody that these things be made, so we're persuaded to buy them. And again, it seems to me that the human factor there is what's demonic, you know, this greedy consumption or greedy selling or whatever the greed is, or it comes down again to the question of when is enough enough, you know, and at what point does the technology really liberate us for real living, and at what point is it just a kind of a childish indulgence that runs ahead, as you say, you know, of the ability to control it includes. So, you know, what I'm saying is, again, that to me it's the human ingredient there that's demonic, not the thing.
And it may be an addendum to that on the question of whether the human factor is the controlling one, and technology represents a kind of neutral extension of human powers. I mean, the sharpest critiques of technology have been those which have said that there is a particular way of viewing the world that is a part of the scientific and technological enterprise. And it's not a neutral, value neutral way at all. I mean, if you think of Jacques Ellul's book, The Technological Society, or John Hall's Light in Our Darkness, it goes something like this in oversimplified form. We picture the world as an object to us, outside of ourselves, an object to be manipulated according to our purposes and design, so that we regard ourselves as kind of an imperial self over against the world that is infinitely malleable and plastic, and a kind of set of resources for our use. And the picture then is one in which the dominant notion of ourselves becomes ourselves as masters, ourselves as controllers, ourselves as conquerors. And this whole tradition from in the West of the last couple of centuries is one which is built right into the scientific enterprise and the technological enterprise, and that's why I ask the question of whether, in fact, it's a sort of neutrality there, or whether it isn't a picture of ourselves, which is really antithetical to seeing humanity as a part of the natural order, and not simply above it, controlling it, manipulating it, and. That's just one remark. The other question is whether, to add to your list, Tom, is whether there aren't some meaningful distinctions to be made among kinds of technologies, because we have generally created increasingly capital-intensive and energy-intensive technologies. Tendency is for technological systems to become more complex, more expensive, and more energy intensive. Now, it doesn't have to be that. I don't think that has to be in the nature of technology itself, but that's the way it's tended to go. And thus, I think there's a direct...
For example?
Machinery, farming tools.
Is a tractor more energy intensive than an equivalent number of draft animals, for instance? I would think probably not.
More labor intensive. I'm contrasting energy intensive with labor intensive, and and also attaching it to the use of renewable and non-renewable resources, which becomes an important factor there as well. And I think by and large the technological systems have become more intensive in terms of capital, energy, and use of renewable and non-renewable resources. But that as I mentioned, is a question of whether one wants to distinguish among those kinds of things. For example, my grandfather sharpened his own razor blade. I think he had a razor blade, the same razor blade, for 20 years. I throw away razor blades. There's just an enormous array.
To me, has nothing to do with technology.
It does if you link it with the first item, namely that the whole spirit that is imbued in modern technology is a spirit in which the world is simply there for human use, and at the human design, with these powers we can master, control, and the world is essentially a storehouse for our undertaking.
I don't see it that way.
No, I know. That's why I asked if it could be added to your list.
To me, technology allows us to use less of the world's resources.
Yeah, I think potentially that's there, and that's but you get enormous institutions committed to the kind of technology we have, and so when you get somebody saying just exactly what you're saying, like E.F. Schumacher and the appropriate technology movement, you get great conflict between that movement and, say, multinational corporations, which have a different technology investment.
Something I think that goes with what you're saying, Tillich talks about that our society has become so involved in thinking more and more and better and bigger, that we've lost the concept of for what. We've lost the value in life, the depth in questioning, you know, the value side of these things. I think that kind of goes with what you're saying about our relationship as stewards to the rest of the land, to our resources. That's just something I'd like to fill in and add to what you're saying.
You're assuming that technology inevitably leads to bigness.
No.
And I guess I'm not completely convinced of that. There's the trend toward bigness and the trend and technology have certainly developed in parallel, but I can cite many instances in which technology allows smallness again.
Does technology tend to lead to consumption?
Well, that's I think the key issue here. Yeah, I say no. Larry, I think says an implied yes. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, where Larry's grandfather was strapping his own razor, we now buy Vicks 10 for 99 and throw them away.
But that's has nothing to do with technology, does
well,
it?
Well, the fact that we know how to make them and we are making them.
They knew how to throw away razor blades in his grandfather's day too, but they didn't. They sharpened them instead because the razor blades, I guess they just didn't have that much money to spend. They didn't have them.
But technology for making them cheaper wasn't there.
Let me throw an example in the medical technology arena, which I think is a challenge for all of us here. Is, you know, we know how to let people die now the same as we always did, but we now have the technology to keep people alive virtually forever. And it's a tremendous decision for all of us, and not just physicians and nurses and social workers, but everybody here. And I don't know how you deal with to hold back the technology that would allow any of you to be here today or your children to survive is unthinkable. And yet, the demonic end of that unthinkable alternative is that we now face a social decision with that technology. I think that's parallel in medicine to what we're facing with throwing away razor blades. It points out that the awareness of all citizens to be a human being at this era in history requires a pretty intimate knowledge of science, as scientists should be required to have a sense of religion and social values, and not just be all little Werner von Braun's.
Somebody over here has a hand open.
Perhaps definition potentially needs to be drawn between technology as something which allows us to use and increase our capabilities for using, and the American way of doing technology, which I think has tended to stress we do it bigger and better, we grow so we can be more efficient in using everything more and more. And I think that is an American feature and may in the end be the downfall of not only this country, but perhaps.
That really includes such things as built-in obsolescence and a few other things that we have described.
And these are the things
that's not a subject again.
That more and more people, and Americans at least, are beginning to feel uncomfortable about or being made to feel uncomfortable about. And yet we're at the end of that. We've gone down that road quite a ways. None of us really want to go back because it's very comfortable where we are. And yet we're being not asked, we're being told that we must share. And it's quite possible that we're going to be forced to share. And I think that's the American brand of technology.
Yeah, but it's not simply American. I mean, when Lenin organized the Soviet state, amazingly, one of the portraits that hung in some of the first factories was a portrait of Henry Ford. And it was because of a hope that industrial socialism, like industrial capitalism, could forge ahead with a common science and technology, a science and technology that both shared. And that was such as assembly line techniques and so on. And now we have industrial socialism and industrial capitalism facing the same set of environmental problems, for example. And it's in part because of a shared kind of technology. I think I would agree with Tom that the technology doesn't have to be that way. It isn't intrinsic in the technology. It could be some other kind of thing. But it isn't simply an American phenomenon here. You're talking about an industrial order that has, as its characteristic, energy-intensive, capital-intensive technology that uses up at a furious rate non-renewable as well as renewable resources. That's a common legacy of this kind of technology.
Went back there.
Yeah, I was going to speak to two basic points. The first of them was the idea of the razor, the way it was done and the way it is done, you know, sharpening or throwing it away. I think in America and probably other developed nations, there is a certain process of approaching a problem. In high technology societies, I think we tend to approach a problem with the question, what can we do, rather than what has to be done. The first is, in high technology societies, we can do a lot more. We have a lot more options, high technology options, than do the developing nations. The other side of that is that the question should be, what is the problem? What do we have to do? Not what can we do? So that kind of speaks, I think, to the razor thing. If we can resharpen the razor, and that solves a problem, why don't we do it? Well, we don't do it for two reasons. Number one, we have the technology to make something very cheaply that you can conveniently throw away. And the second part of that is that the reason we produce it that way is that there's market pressure from society craving something easy. And I think that power, that pressure, is in existence on technology also. I guess that's basically my answer.
Okay. Werner?
And is it the problem of technology, or is it the problem that theology, the church, and other disciplines in society haven't been able to keep up with the rapid advancement of technology, so that we're not able to use appropriately the technology that we have. Maybe technology has advanced at a much more rapid rate than, you know, other disciplines in society, and therefore, you know, we can't use it.
What would be an example, Warner?
Well, I mean, you know, again, I don't think it's the technology that's causing the problems, but our inability to deal with the technology, so that rather than using technology for our good, we're using it to produce a waste society, a throwaway society. Whereas if we really, you know, believed what the scripture says, or what the sociologist would say about the effects of this or that, well, then it would be obvious that we don't approach technology with that approach. And we don't have to use technology in that way. Mm-hmm. It's not technology's fault. It's that we're not able to cope with the technology that we have. And maybe the fault is the theologian, the preacher, that has joined technology rather than kept with the scriptures, or maybe it's other disciplines in society that haven't been able to keep up with technology, so that we were able to deal with it.
Yeah, I'd suggest that even that it's a lack of understanding of science and technology. The people who it seems to me who are most vocal on some of the current issues of science associated with science and technology are the people who argue from almost a zero base of understanding. I can think of a couple examples. I was living out in Boston at the time of the big DNA controversy in Cambridge. I don't know how much that hit the national newspapers, but the city council in Cambridge, and in particular the mayor, decided that they should be controlling DNA or recombinant DNA research at MIT and Harvard. And that, of course, these were two of the leading laboratories in doing research on recombinant DNA, and so they almost succeeded in getting through the Cambridge City Council regulations that would have virtually put applied genetic research at MIT and Harvard out of business, at least for the time being. Another instance, of course, is the I feel, and I'm sure I'll get some disagreement on this, is the character of the anti-nuclear energy campaign, which I feel is being led, and a lot of people are participating in it that don't really have much knowledge of how nuclear energy is generated, or the technical ramifications of it. But I think that there's a great deal of this, and there will be more of people wanting to make decisions on technology, but not wanting to do their homework.
Yeah.
Right.
That certainly is the case. At the same time, it's important, I think, to recognize that the sharpest critiques of science and technology in the last half dozen years have arisen from within that establishment itself, and not simply from the relatively uninformed. I mean, I think of Langdon Winner's book on autonomous technology, which is one of the most pervasive critiques of at least our kind of technology, and that's written by an MIT professor from the heart of the establishment. Or the DNA, as long as you mentioned DNA, the person that called for the moratorium on DNA research in the first place was instrumental to, was from within the inside too, in Watson. Or the World Council of Churches important conference on faith, science, and the future last summer at MIT, which was at least half scientists and technologists among the people that called were there and that called for the moratorium on nuclear power development. All those kinds of things, that sort of critique and the kind of sobering of a view, of an earlier more optimistic view toward science and technology, have arisen from within the establishment and not simply from the uninformed without.
Right. One of the problems is not only technology, but it's the technician that it works with, the technologist. The technician hasn't been trained to do what the technology is bringing to him. In other words, at one time I did work with broadcast equipment. The engineers were developing certain types of broadcast equipment. In the laboratories it worked fine. They knew what they were doing. But on a basis where they could bring it out to the men, and a piece may have cost $5,000 in the laboratory, but they wanted us to make it for 20 cents. So I don't think the technician and their work is keeping up with what he's brought to them. So they are advancing much further, faster than they should. Or they can, I should say. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
I was going to get back if we could, or pick that up, but I just would be, I'm close to science and yet feel very uninformed on the nuclear issue, and unless everybody here is overdosed on it, I'd welcome your input and anybody else that's informed. I consider myself a scientist that's ill-informed, and I'd really like to know. I think I can perceive some of the potential real problems and yet some of the potential real needs, and what's your assessment?
That there are real problems and real needs.
It's going to come down to a vote, really, and unlike some of the more nebulous things we've been attaching, which are we could discuss that you couldn't vote on, I perceive there's an issue that we as concerned citizens may have to pull a lever and vote on.
I don't know what we're going to vote on.
I think we're going to vote on extension of nuclear energy or not.
Whether we're going to have it or not. I hope that won't be the case.
I may be wrong. I think that's going to be the case.
Yeah, that I think would be a disaster if a thing like that were put up to vote.
Issues like that on the California ballot already. Referendums.
Yeah. And it was almost a disaster. Yeah. But, if you want, I can try to put a semester's course into 5 minutes.
Well, if you could deal with the major opponents, which it seems to me the China Syndrome movie illustrates potential disaster, maybe deal with that first.
Well, there's very good science and technology in that movie. I could assure you of that. That is not based. You know, I enjoyed the movie, but as long as you don't take it too seriously. But there are problems, of course. There are problems with any type of energy generation. You've heard the expression said so often, there ain't no free lunch. By definition, when you deal, energy is the ability to do work. And when you deal with large amounts of energy, you deal with potential hazard. And it doesn't make any difference what form of energy generating system talk about. There's great hazard. I happen to think, and I think it's been pretty well documented, that nuclear power generation is one of the less hazardous forms, but it still is very hazardous. It doesn't hold a candle, say, to electrical generation by coal, where there are millions of documented deaths. Nuclear energy doesn't come close to that, and I don't happen to think ever will. I would like to see more effort go into reducing hazards of energy generation and distribution of all types. I'd like to see hydroelectric dams made safer. I'd like to see coal generation made much more environmentally acceptable, if it can. I'd like to see nuclear power made much safer than it is, in particular some of the technological problems like waste disposal and safeguarding nuclear fuels and things of that sort, I think should be. We should put more effort into solving these. I'd like to see us deal with some of the potential hazards of solar energy before we get knee-deep into it. And so I'm 100% in favor of more research. In fact, I'd like to see these problems anticipated before they arise. That's probably the biggest mistake that we tend to make, is putting new technologies online, especially in the field of power generation, where everything is dangerous, potentially dangerous. Putting new systems online and then starting to worry about some of the safety problems and environmental problems. I'd like to see those anticipated in advance, even if it does slow down the rate of the use of technology. I won't say it slows down technology, but it slows down the rate of utilization of technology.
Well, isn't that the big thing with nuclear energy, though, is the waste?
Well, it's I happen to feel, at least, and I'm sure there are plenty of people here that will disagree, that it's not as great a problem as it is with coal utilization, for example. That we do potentially, or that we do have within our technology the means of disposing of nuclear waste more readily than we have in our technology the way of dealing with waste from coal burning power generation right now. This acid rain thing just scares the dickens out of me. Yeah. It's scaring an awful lot of people. The particulate. You know, the damage to lungs that we've, for years we've been dumping fly ash and particulate into the atmosphere and causing horrendous health problems. That, I think we can say we have the technology of dealing with. We can remove these kinds of particulates from stack gases. We're not doing it to the extent that I'd like to see it done, but we know how. It's a matter of cost. But the emission of noxious gases, acid-forming gases, I'm not sure that anyone has an answer to that right now.
You know? Not even the emission of radiation from coal-burning plants is greater than from nuclear.
Yeah, then it is. Almost all coal, I think, mined in this country has radioactive material in it, and that's vented directly to the atmosphere. And we don't have standards, say, on the amount of radiation a coal-burning power plant can emit, but we have very stringent standards on the amount of radiation a nuclear power plant can emit.
What kinds of damage happens from the radiation from coal? I read about what happens from the radioactive waste of nuclear power that I don't know about.
Well, essentially the same thing. I think the most hazardous effect of radiation is when it gets into the food supply, therefore gets into is ingested in some way into our bodies, and that doesn't really. It's similar, regardless of whether it comes from stack emission in a coal plant or whether it comes from radiation from a nuclear plant. Yeah.
I am from Tulsa, Washington, which is about 5 miles from the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant in Oregon. And one thing I wanted to say was that the way they developed that plant was at the very beginning of the nuclear protest era, and they built the plant in a very, very rural, lightly populated area in Oregon, but right on the Columbia River, and all the licensing was done through the state of Oregon, and yet the population center was right across the river in the state of Washington, and yet there was no regulatory power with the state of Washington, and so that kind of just slipped right through, and all of a sudden they're building this giant cooling tower right across the river from the community, you know, and so it's kind of interesting the way that developed. But let me say this, I'm a supporter of nuclear power, and I think that I can have some right to say that, because I do live in the shadow of the nuclear power plant myself, and so, you know, assuming that there was ever an accident, potentially there could be a disaster for me personally. And the reason I support nuclear power is because until this country can some way quell its insatiable appetite for energy, we've got to do whatever we can to relieve the pressure on our government to expand internationally in terms of quelling this appetite for energy. And I really feel like you can't just turn off all nuclear power because it's going to increase so much pressure that you really increase the danger of the nuclear holocaust simply because we're going to be so aggressive in terms of seeking other sources of energy. You just can't turn off nuclear power in the country. It doesn't work.
Yeah. In our area, the only time we hear about the acid rain is when the fishing isn't good. Isn't there an awful lot of other organisms that would be harming? Well, it's yes, of course. Agriculture is probably one of the biggest dangers of all. Its effect on plant life all over the country, all over the world.
Yeah, I thought I read someplace it's a very insignificant increase in the percentage of acid rain would wipe out or cut the yield considerably on crops.
Hey, have any of you ever driven through Sudbury, Ontario, which is where the Canadians have a very large chemical industry, and it's just like driving on the moon, really. It's the most depressing sight you've ever seen. For many miles around the city, nothing grows. No plant life. It's just absolutely barren. You're coming out of these beautiful north woods, driving along the Ottawa River, and all of a sudden it ends, and then you're in no man's land. But to realize that that human beings and animals and so on have been breathing that same air that has killed plant life for 380 many years, but misuse or pollution of the environment has kind of just slipped by unnoticed. If that same kind of thing had hit by nuclear power, we would have had almost a revolution, I feel.
Just recently I read that every day in the United States we would fill the kingdom three times full with waste products from general industry, whereas if you took nuclear waste from the time man got on Earth, you wouldn't have filled it once. And yet, every day we fill it three times with waste in the United States. If you took the total nuclear waste, you wouldn't fill it from the time man started using nuclear energy. So it gives you a sense of proportion in terms of volume.
I don't know about that, because I think the waste from nuclear power is a lot more concentrated, and 1% of 1 ounce of plutonium could kill a person, die in their lungs.
Less many centuries.
Well, one thimble full of botulinum poison would kill everybody in the city of New York.
But then people can choose whether they're going to use the bicat.
What's that?
You said
vodka? No, vodka.
We live in Idaho, right near the big nuclear energy site there that employs, 10,000 people. So most of our town is oriented toward that that industry. And it's been interesting. I feel a frustration trying to decide how I feel about nuclear energy, because being there, the predominant feeling of the scientific community there is, they're giving their professional lives to the development of this energy. And on the other hand, I have a lot of friends who are very much against nuclear energy. I feel a that there's a real naivete on both sides of the issue, on both extremes of the issue, especially. The anti-nuclear people naively, I believe, feel that we can reduce our energy needs and come up with alternative sources and somehow do without nuclear energy. Some of the scientific community, on the other hand, that is involved with this, I think naively feels that if the public only understood nuclear energy, they would accept it. And it's only a problem that they don't understand and they're speaking out of ignorance. And I think it's a much greater question than that. It's a philosophical question about nuclear energy, not just a matter of we don't understand it, therefore we don't accept it. And I think the scientific community does a very bad PR job when they use this approach. Would you add to that? We've discussed this. Help me.
I agree that scientists are terrible at PR. But I must be doubly naive because I guess I agree with both groups. I agree with your anti-nuclear friends that we can do without nuclear energy if we have to. But I also agree with your pro-nuclear friends that a lot of it is due to a lack of understanding. A lot of the opposition is due to a lack of understanding. So I must be doubly naive.
What I would add to that is that my reaction is that the nuclear, or the technological, if you please, people are terribly naive regarding psychology and politics in the best sense of the word. There's an assumption that once something is explained logically or technologically or some way or other, that takes care of it. That now that it's explained, people will certainly go along with it. They seem to have very little sense of the potential paranoia quotient of anything like nuclear energy, which can't be seen, felt, tasted, or whatever, and which has immeasurable half-life and all of that, and do not have a sense of what it does to people and how they react to something like that can't be seen and measured. A very significant part of the problem, I think, is that total insensitivity to politics, to understanding, to people, to psychology, to where people are.
I couldn't agree more. Larry, and then
I'll try to make it short. Yeah. What is the case for nuclear power technology is also the case for a number of the kind of concentrations of high technology that we have. And I don't think we've given enough attention to the psychological components involved with what Amory Lovins calls the centralizing tendencies of high technology. That is to say, you require large organizations that require enormous investments of capital, in which the education required is of a very high level, so that a lot of people who make the decisions have to have a very highly specialized education and represent a kind of technological elite, or a corporation elite, or decision-making elite. And these centralizing tendencies on the part of our technologies leaves people with a status of consumer, to be sure. But they often feel very far removed from the kind of decisions that are being made which affect their lives. And that kind of sense of powerlessness and alienation of not understanding nuclear power, etc., and still being so affected by it, I think that's a part of a lot of the kind of technology we have. And there's nothing neutral in the consequences.
I'm going to ask whether I could change the subject a little bit. I think it's certainly related, and that is, seems to me one of the big issues here is how is the undeveloped world, which is very substantial, going to be raised to some level of what we would even consider humanitarian way of living without technology. And I guess I'd like to
ask the critics of technology what they propose. How are you going to feed, what is it, 500 million Indians and a billion Chinese and all the rest of the people? And is it somewhat arrogant for us to start saying we're going to start limiting technology when half the world is very much in need of technology?
This was a question that came up this afternoon.
I want to reply to that. Two things. In my studies of third world issues and hunger problem, technology more often than not has been part of the problem and not part of the solution. That's not technology itself as how it's been used in a very exploitive way. We could spend all night talking about that.
Can you get an example?
Okay, a lot of times, I can't get down to specific companies, I don't think that's fair anyway, but a lot of times loans will be given with the understanding that that particular government will buy so much machinery from this particular company. There's a whole system of creating dependence there. Fertilizers, okay, that's probably a good example. There was all kinds of research done with the Green Revolution in Mexico. That was successful to a point, but there were too many things that it never reached the people it was meant for. The new seeds were too expensive, they required too much fertilizer, too many extras for the poor farmers to ever even get a handle on that. Too many things have failed because we weren't looking at what the real causes of hunger are. The other thing that goes along with that, world hunger isn't caused by a lack of enough food. We've got enough food to feed the world and then some. It's how that food is distributed, it's how our system works it's probably easier to give examples. I spent some time in Colombia. Colombia's got some of the richest soil in the world. Their problem wasn't that they didn't grow enough food. The problem was that companies were down there, were working, all their land was used for coffee, for commercial flowers, that kind of thing going on. The fact that they can't use their land to produce food because they don't have any control over it in most cases. So that I think, our technology can help there in some ways, but before that can do anything, we have to make some changes in the way we associate economically in the third world. The United States has done more harm through all our programs than we've ever done good when it comes to third world issues and hunger problems.
We might get some disagreement on that.
Hardly put a question mark, as Larry. Yeah. I think there'd be a lot of question to that.
I think it's a hard question to make a very broad generalization to say that the United States has done more harm than good to these countries. Maybe there's been some accidental harm there, but I think you have to substantiate that. I guess I'd take issue just because you can't make a flat statement like that without backing, without some backing.
If you look in the Mother Jones issue, November, you'll find a whole section on something called dumping. And there have been some things that have been banned in the United States, things that have been manufactured through our technology. And since it was banned in the United States, the manufacturers sent to the third world countries that trusted us. And one example is we sent some oxygen devices for people who needed breath right away, couldn't get it, to Kenya. And here they trusted us, and they were defective. So we didn't use them in the United States, so people died trusting us. And this was because our technology, developed effective things. And then we banned them from our country and from our third world countries. We sold them.
That's
intertwined with technology.
I guess I didn't follow this. As you say, our technology developed defective things. Technology failed in that case.
Yeah, it did fail, and I guess our economics got intertwined in there.
You're talking about corporate responsibility there, companies.
Yeah.
For one reason we're banned here, going over the border.
One could argue equally strongly that's a failure of theology in our society to enter where it belongs most, which is at every corporate and street level. And you could equally well argue that the
position of theology in the ages, which everyone in a group like Holden, where it's unique because of open discussion, that the blindness of theologians, priests, and others has prejudiced to people against religion and has driven scientists away. And it's only the kind of open discussion that we have here that holds hope for the future.
Well, that sense, religion, you know, should really be the most radical, leading-edge institution in the world instead of being recognized as a conservative holdback. That should be way out in front, taking the real risk.
Certainly in population control, that's been a problem, isn't it? And not just the Catholic Church, but many other people who have misinterpreted in many ways the whole issues of the world. It's going to be, we're going to kill ourselves by overpopulation if we don't do something about it.
I think one of the big problems is the way our economy is set up, so that if you develop the technology for a perfect solar energy cell that costs 20 cents for, you know, megawatts, there's no reason that should be developed because there's not much money in it. And so,
I should think you'd sell a lot of them.
You'd sell a lot, but maybe for 20 cents a piece. But
look at calculators. A few years ago, they cost $200. Now they cost $7 or less than that, I guess.
But
the people that make the calculators are making a much greater profit by selling millions of them for $5 or whatever than they did by selling just a few for a large figure. Wouldn't the same be true of a solar setup? You could develop one that was very, very cheap and very efficient.
Well, I think like Standard Oil can ignore solar energy. They're going fine with oil, so they can just pretend it doesn't exist or that it's impossible.
It's kind of an interesting example because that raises an issue that we haven't touched on. The oil companies are getting into solar energy development in a big way, partly because they've got so darn much money laying around they don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And Mobil and Exxon and these companies are putting a lot of money into solar energy research. And there are many people, that especially in Congress, that feel that they ought not to be allowed to do so because this leads to an energy monopoly, or could lead to an energy monopoly, because they're getting in on the ground floor of this new technology. On the other hand, the public and private sectors have not been willing to invest the kind of money that the oil companies now have to invest. And this is, you know, something I've mulled over many times. Should Standard Oil be in the solar energy business?
Well, do you think they will go into it?
They're in a big way, really. Exxon, Mobil.
Maybe they can make money out of it, but if they couldn't make money out of it.
Well, of course they're in it because they feel that there'll be a profit.
Okay.
They all hope to develop this 20-cent solar cell that they can sell billions of.
Do you think if they can make more money in nuclear or oil, they would still go into solar?
Well, they haven't gone into nuclear.
But
they have gone into
solar.
Theoretical
company.
Yeah.
Well, we have to remember that we're still in a capitalistic society, and Standard Oil has no obligation to go into solar energy unless they can turn a profit. You can argue pros and cons on a capitalistic society, but that's still the way it is. And they're not going to go into solar just because it's a popular thing. They're going to go into solar because they can make money on it.
Yeah, I think
if there's no money in it, their stockholders would expect them not to go into it.
But should they be allowed to?
That seems to be an issue
that's really coming up in Washington.
They can't win. They're also criticized for buying Montgomery Ward and going the other business. They can't win.
The hazard there probably is analogous to what happened in Los Angeles many years ago in the automobile industry, or part of it at least. bought out the interurban system they had, the light rail system, scrapped it in order to sell more automobiles, created a monstrosity that is now Los Angeles. You know.
General Motors did that with a lot of the railroads in the country. It wasn't just Los Angeles, but railroad lines were out the country.
Well, the Supreme Court just basically upheld this whole idea 2 days ago when they allowed people and corporations to patent new life forms. And this is
patent what?
New.
You're allowed to patent new life forms, the recombinant DNA and DNA and so on. Those types of things are now allowed to be patented. And what this basically will allow is for corporations to make money on it, and therefore it will allow the research to continue, which requires large amounts of money. And so the highest court in the land has now said this is okay to do, and it's going to have far-reaching effects on all types of research. If you can patent new life forms, you can patent anything, and that's just backing up the capitalistic society.
Yeah, you had a question on the patents.
Let's
a slight correction as far as the nuclear is concerned. Standard Oil is into nuclear. At least Exxon has a significant investment
in the field. Yeah, you're right. When I thought of nuclear, I was thinking of nuclear of technology. That's right. They have holdings in uranium mining operations.
And into coal reprocessing in Idaho.
So we have to be able to give them the advantage or give them a reason to go into better energy systems. If the money isn't there, they have no reason for going into it.
Well, in my opinion, a lot more of this should be should come from public monies, but we failed to do that. And in fact, as we're talking about this afternoon, there's something, in my opinion, there's something very queer about the mentality of the American public. We allow the price of gasoline to go up 5 cents, 10 cents, 20 cents, 30 cents, 70, 90, and we grumble a little bit, but I don't see very many people out in the street carrying signs. Well, very recently there have been, but the response has been very disappointing. But let President Carter propose, as he has on a couple of occasions, a substantial increase in gas tax, and the cry is heard from coast to coast. There's something about, that tax is a three-letter word. And as long as we pay it to Standard Oil and to the foreign oil exporters, why, we don't seem to mind. But if we have to pay it to our government, we scream bloody murder. You know, every time the price of gas increases one penny at the pump, and that has happened many, many times, I don't need to remind you, costs the American consumer something like $1.2 billion. And $1.2 billion is probably more than we have spent on research and development of alternative forms of energy in the country's history. We're stepping up the level of research on energy sources in this country. But compared with what energy costs, why, it's pennies. We could, with 1 cent tax on gasoline, we could in 1 year pay for all the research that we've ever done.
Do you know why that hasn't happened?
As I say, I don't understand the mentality of people. I know why it hasn't happened, but I can't justify it, because we just won't accept the idea of a tax on motor fuel for our automobiles, other than to a dedicated tax where all of it goes to road building, which is true of the present gasoline tax. But as far as developing alternative forms of energy, we won't accept it.
The federal government is doing a lot of research on solar.
Well, it depends upon what you mean a lot. Mm-hmm. A few hundred million dollars.
Well, this could
be. But compared with $1.2 billion, you know, compared to the $1.2 billion that you raise on every penny of gas tax, why, that's a pretty small amount. I, at least in my, you know, in my economic balance, it's peanuts, it's small.
Our time is about up, but I thought the question about the third world people is an awfully important one, and we haven't given it much time. I think it's rather clear that we certainly need, in the sense of much more sophisticated technologies than we have now, if those questions of third world countries are to be addressed. What seems to me quite clear is that we cannot talk about repeating in third world countries the kinds of patterns of our own technologies. I mean, the problem is enormous force of the unemployed. It's rural poverty. To go to kind of technologies that increase production enormously but do it by a very small portion of the labor force and that benefit essentially urbanized sectors is not the kind of technology that's needed. In a sense, we need a level of sophistication and kinds of technology that we do not now have for those kinds of countries. And I think that's where the appropriate technology movement and such things are represent in a sense the cutting edge if you're talking about need, but that's a long ways from the kinds of patterns of technology that we have and the kind that institutions want to transfer. I mean, I don't know American multinational corporations desiring to really attack the question of rural poverty. In Tanzania, where I was last year, the way in which American technology was involved was all in ways that did not benefit address the question of rural poverty, increase the number of jobs. It was for the major third world problem. It's a disaster.
You used a phrase that I liked, Larry. You said patterns of technology.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's part of the. Maybe it is important to distinguish between technology and patterns.
That's
why
I would not. That's why I would not characterize my views as anti-technological. Yes. I'm anti some kinds and patterns of technology and some uses, but not. It seems to me foolish to be pro-technology or anti-technology as if that were some monolithic thing.
We can export the same technology and have it the pattern develop as capital intensive or labor intensive. Now, I'm of course very much an advocate of shifting the pattern in this country from capital intensive, energy intensive, particularly to more labor intensive. But that still employs the same technology. It doesn't. It isn't really a matter of changing technology. It's a matter of changing the way in which we manufacture things. If I could make one change in the tax laws in this country, which I am sure I shall never be allowed to be in a position to do, I would reverse the tax incentives for capital equipment and capital investment, and for research and development. You see, our tax laws are written in such a way that if a company invests X million dollars in capital equipment to produce more goods, they get a real tax break. They can take a fairly fast tax write-off. And in essence, we're saying that it's very important to produce more goods. So therefore, we'll subsidize, we'll pay part of the cost of increasing production. But if a company decides it doesn't want to produce more goods, but it wants to produce better goods, improve its product through research and development, that money has to be paid for out of corporate profits. There's no tax incentive for that.
Yep,
and
exactly.
I would exactly reverse those and say that the big tax write-off ought to come for putting more money into research and development. The much maligned telephone utility, old Ma Bell, has been doing that for years. When you pay your phone bill, feel comforted or feel persecuted in the fact that 2 cents or 2.5 cents, I guess, on the dollar of that is going to research and development. Well, think what has come out of Bell Labs. Besides having the world's best telephone system, the transistor, the laser, you can just go right down the list and of the things that have been developed by that money. But unfortunately, most large companies in the United States don't put that kind of money back into research and development.
When you say, this is kind of a flippant comment I have to make, but when you say, changing from capital intensive to labor intensive, I'd just be curious, for an example, the first thing that comes to my mind is, energy intensive rather, is to have people running on a treadmill to run a factory instead of having...
Well, that would be the only problem. That would be the extreme. I'd like to see more people engaged in repairing things than producing new things.
Yeah. But to get to that point, it's like in the housing industry, anything that is done by people today is so expensive that that's why it's cheaper to throw
and
away.
Things that have been done by energy have been very cheap,
yeah.
But we're on our way to reversing this as energy prices soar. If we believe in the Holden philosophy that we ought to ask ourselves, how much do we need, rather than how much would we like to have? Why, maybe even the price of labor won't go up as fast as it has in the past.
Well, I think there's one reality, and that is the average standard of living is going to go down. In this whole process for the individuals.
Well,
and now you can measure standard of living. Whether a lot of the junk you get is valuable, but as we measure in the gross national product. It hasn't gone up in the last 6 years, and unless we do some drastic changes, it's going to go down considerably. Actually, the way we're kidding the people now is with the inflation rate we've got, 18 to 20%.
I don't think I agree with the statement that it hasn't gone up, but in fact, I would say that we don't really have to lower the standard of living. I guess we've gone way over 10 here. I don't think we really have to lower the standard of living if we're willing to accept a slower rate of increase of the standard of living. Why I think we'll be showing a real improvement in both the economy and the utilization of natural resources.
Well, the data that I've seen says that we have actually gone down, and what we're doing. People are consuming the resources. They're getting bigger mortgages in their houses. They're consuming the resources they have. They're consuming their savings.
Bigger mortgages and bigger houses.
We have one of the lowest saving rates in the world.
Right. That's one of the danger signs in our economy, I think.